Yeah, I'm Derek Brooks, and I worked as a journalist on the South Yorkshire Times initially in South Yorkshire, unbelievably, and then I moved to the Bristol Evening Post. I was a journalist from 1980 to 2006 when I left the Post. I initially got into journalism as a student. I worked on the student newspaper at Sheffield Polytechnic, as was then, and that developed my interest in it. And looking around for something to do after college, I thought this might be the best thing for me, so I did that, and that was the start of my fairly long career in journalism.
Did you find it easy to get into in Yorkshire?
Well, I was fairly lucky in that basically I just sent letters off to as many newspapers as I could, and the various weeklies throughout the country. I wasn't initially bothered where I was going to live, and the South Yorkshire Times just happened to be one that A, answered my letter, and B, eventually had a vacancy, and then I took it from there then. So it was, I found it fairly easy, yeah, at the time.
When you first started work then, how did you find the job? Was it how you expected? Did you find it, difficult to get used to, doing very different things day after day? The other thing is, were you out of the office much?
Well, I initially started as a trainee reporter in the central office. And then with more experience, with about 2 years' experience, they then ushered me out to the Barnsley district office, where I was responsible for one edition of the paper, basically providing front page news for every week. That was quite interesting. I was the Barnsley district reporter when the miners' strike broke in 1984, and the strike, as you may remember, started at Coughton Wood Pit in Barnsley, where my district office was about half a mile from Coughton Wood. So it was extremely interesting, possibly the most exciting time of my journalistic life, and which for me ended in the wrong result. But the heroism, literally, of the miners and their families who had to put up with the most brutal policies of that Thatcher government, and of course the violence perpetrated against them by the police on a regular basis, were provided a lot of news, and it's something that I was proud to be there at the time and to know those people.
Was there anything that happened during that period that for you typified the struggle of the miners? Any stories that were happening, or particular individuals?
Well, there was a NUM official at Cadby, I remember, who his son was a policeman, so I asked him the obvious question: well, has that brought you into conflict with your son? As there had been a lot of violence on picket lines, mostly started by police, and he told me that he didn't speak to his son anymore because of that, and I found that extremely moving.
And what insight did it give you into the sort of wider picture of what was going on during the miners' strike?
Well, it just confirmed that the sort of philosophy that I had already, in that it's basically the trade union movement is there to be shot down by the people in power, because the trade unions represent a threat to them in a way, mainly because the trade unions try to seek a fairer, more just society. Well, that will always be at the expense, I suppose, of the people that run the place. And certainly the miners' strike proved that the injustices that were meted out to the miners at that time was just, if you hadn't seen it firsthand, it would have been unbelievable. But it did sort of, if you like, galvanise my belief in the worth of belonging to the trade union movement. At least it let us know that we were on the right side, if nothing else.
Well, that brings me on to talk about the union. Did you join the NUJ when you were actually up in Barnsley?
Yes, I joined on day one, and I've remained a member ever since, obviously. And when I started on my first paper, I virtually straight away joined the union chapel there, and as an official, as a clerk, and then then became the deputy, and then the FOC of the chapel at the South Yorkshire Times. Had similar battles there to what I was to experience later at the Evening Post. I moved from the South Yorkshire Times to the Evening Post and became the chapel clerk there, then the deputy FOC, and then the FOC, and remained the FOC for about 16, 17 years.
As regards your union membership, why did you think it was so important to join? I mean, you said on day one. What was the reason?
Because I've always felt that employers will always try to exploit you. They'll always try to get the most out of you for the least pay. And I've seen it firsthand with people being treated very, very badly if they didn't have the organisation of a trade union behind them. And I've just always known from a very early age, really. I've always believed from a very early age that the only way that you can defend both yourself and other people, because the trade union movement is not just about, obviously, defending yourself against people that want to exploit you, but it's also about helping other people, which has been the mainstay of the trade union movement. I think people always try to help other people as well as themselves, and that was why I got involved with the union straight away. I realised that that's what I always wanted to do.
Now, before we talk about your move down to the Evening Post in Bristol, I'm fascinated by this miners' strike business. And you being a journalist during that time, do you feel that the public's perceptions were in any way changed by the way the media, the wider media reported the strike?
Only when it was too late. The miners had been defeated by the time all of the lies in the media came out. Then when I talk about the media, I'm mostly talking about the tabloid national newspapers, which on a regular basis put out scare stories about the miners, and without even bothering with the truth of the matter.
So what sort of stories were put out that you felt were distorted?
Well, mostly to do with the violence. In the early days of the strike, when there were hardly any policemen on the picket lines, there was no violence whatsoever. It was an amazing coincidence that as soon as policemen started turning up in large numbers in vans, that suddenly violence started breaking out. And that was mostly, if you remember that, especially that summer of 84, when miners were going around in jeans and T-shirts and to be faced by people, policemen in riot gear. It beggars belief that the miners could be out looking for a fight against these people. Obviously, it wasn't the case. The police were wading into them, and for no good reason most of the time.
Were there any specific incidents that you can remember that for you typified the miners' struggle and the sorts of injustices that you saw at those times with the sort of heavy-handed police tactics?
Well, I mean, the barbarity of it sometimes was incredible. But some of the things that really stuck in my mind were the things that were more to do with the humour of the miners, really, and their families. There was a famous one at I think it was Denneby Main Colliery, could have been Cadeby though, where they built a snowman over an iron post, and the police in the transit van came just. Just for a laugh, the police wanted to run over the snowman, and they run into an iron post instead. That, for me, really sort of typified what was going on, really. As well as, obviously, the police sellotaping £10 notes to the inside of the windows to signify the amount of money they were getting in overtime pay, while miners were having their benefits cut by the government. But as far as the media, of course, the media sort of just wanted, had one agenda, and that was to defeat the miners. They were on Margaret Thatcher's agenda. And by the time the lies in the media came out, of course, it was too late then. The miners had sadly lost the greatest industrial battle since the Second World War, and we've all paid the price for it since then.
Was there ever any pressure on you in a similar direction to distort the reporting of the miners' strike in your paper?
No, not really. I think there's a big difference between national newspapers and local newspapers. In my local newspaper, the South Yorkshire Times, had 17 pits at the start of the miners' strike within its circulation area. And most of our readers were miners' families. For one, you could never get away with distorting the truth in that case. But so, of course, local newspapers are far more responsible towards their readers, and unlike the national tabloids. And so we didn't distort anything really. As far, you know, we just reported what we saw in a fairly straightforward manner. And I was quite pleased to do so.
Okay, and so when did you move down to Bristol, and you know, what was the reason for that?
Well, because I was working on a weekly paper, and I wanted to move to a daily. And living at the time in Sheffield, I wanted to get a job on the Sheffield Star, an evening newspaper there. But my timing was very bad, because just at that time, the early part of 86 and late 85, the Sheffield Morning Telegraph, the sister paper of the evening of the Star, was closed down, making 70-odd journalists redundant. And, of course, a lot of the journalists who were working on the Sheffield Morning Telegraph transferred to the Star. And that meant that people such as myself, who were looking to get into daily newspapers in Sheffield, couldn't do that at the time, because there was a lot of redundant, quite rightly, the jobs were going to the journalists that were being made redundant. So I looked elsewhere, and again, just did exactly the same thing as I did looking for a weekly job. I just sent a letter of application to every evening paper in the country. Some of them replied and some of them didn't. And one of them that did reply was the Bristol Evening Post, and they said they'd keep me on the file, and then they called me soon afterwards to say a vacancy had arose, and had an interview, and luckily for me, I managed to get a job. I was very pleased to work on the Evening Post in Bristol. I thought it was an excellent newspaper.
What about ownership of those two papers? I mean, the newspapers in Sheffield and here. Have you noticed a difference in the management, the way the papers are managed?
Well, I think that what happened was the same has happened in many papers. As the 80s went on, and Mrs. Thatcher became ever more powerful, and the Conservative government through the 80s and early 90s became ever more corrupt, in my opinion. They gave the lead to managements up and down the country, not just newspapers, to be more aggressive with their workers. One big consequence of the defeat of the miners, in my opinion, was the defeat of the wider trade union movement. And, of course, membership dropped dramatically in the 80s and 90s. And managements took great satisfaction in being ever more aggressive as the years went on. I've seen that in my time. When I first started the Evening Post, we had a fairly decent dialogue with management, with the NUJ. But, you know, we had our little arguments, of course, and we wanted to try and settle them quite amicably, which I think we did mostly. But as time went on and they realised that they could get away with more, the management changed, actually, as did the editor. And the whole outlook of relationships with the NUJ in the late 80s began to change quite transparently, really, and they became much more aggressive. I was by that time the FOC at the Bristol Evening Post, and it was quite apparent to me that that the new editor, Adrian Faber, had been brought in with a mission to get rid of the NUJ, as was happening in other papers up and down the country. And they did make it very difficult for us. They didn't treat us with any respect. And
when was it you first realised that there was this kind of new management philosophy going on?
Well, I think when the introduction of the new editor, basically, he came with, as I said, that up until that time, I think I joined the Evening Post in 86, and up and for the first few years, the paper was quite a, what I would call a liberal paper. It had an agenda and which it reported and was fair to all sides. But when Adrian Faber came to the paper, he came with a mission to take the paper down market. And with that, there was a lot of stories that were getting into the paper which were just rubbish, basically. Also, we didn't reflect the readership of the paper. You know, we're going down market. Didn't reflect the readership of lower middle class people. We, over the years, we eventually found ourselves not having any pictures of black people, for instance, in the Evening Post, which in a city with a large Afro-Caribbean community was an outrage. And it was just, and then when, you know, the editors and the management told me as an FOC to F off in negotiations, I started quickly getting the idea that things were not going my way. And that was proved to be the case. They, along with other newspapers throughout the country, they de-recognised the Evening Post in the early 90s. The Evening Post was 94. And without any negotiations with the union at all, going back to the, in 94, there was a very low morale amongst the trade union movements at that time because of various defeats. The Tories were running rampant at that time. And it was a very, very difficult time for trade unionists. And
can you just take us from the arrival of this new editor to the stage where that was actually officially de-recognised? I imagine it didn't just happen overnight. It was a gradual process.
Yeah, it took a few years. We had a union agreement, which was quite a comprehensive one, actually, which was quite proud. We were quite proud of at the Evening Post. It's dealt with, you know, the basic bread and butter issues such as wages and a salary structure whereby you could rise up a salary structure depending on the job that you did and the experience that you had. We were quite proud of the way we defended that. Of course, what happened after the new editor came was they started taking more liberties with us. That we were finding it more difficult to come to an agreement, and it all culminated really, with us not being able to talk to the editor very well at all, really, until we just were faced with a letter from the management, which obviously had been organised from not only locally but I think throughout the country, really, managements were organising themselves together to confront the NUJ and to say, well, you're no longer recognised. The unit, the agreement we've got is, in, to use their language, out of date, reflects working arrangements from previous times. And now we're looking to negotiate individually with people their salaries and their terms of conditions. And, of course, when people negotiate on their own, or in many cases don't negotiate at all, obviously, in real life, many people don't go into the editor, start asking for wage rises all the time. Lots of people expect to work hard and be given a rise because they're worth it, basically. So what we found was that when the union was derecognised in 1994, people were being brought in, new starters were being brought in on lower salaries than the people who were already there, because the people who were already there had their salaries initially negotiated by the union. And so as years went by, people came in on lower and lower money. And to the effect that by the time the union was recognised again in 2002, people coming in 2002 were getting no more money than the people who were getting, newly qualified staff were getting when the union was derecognised in 1994. The company had used that opportunity of not having an organised union defending wages to cut wages year by year. And so there'd been absolutely no rise in wages for newly qualified staff in all that time of derecognition. Which I think shows that when the company now talk about, oh, you don't need a union to get a good wage, it just goes to show what absolute piffle that is, really. And people who tend to believe that should really sort of take a look at that what actually happened. And it's quite apparent to me that the people who have the best wages in the journalism industry are the ones whose conditions are negotiated by the union.
So we've heard about the dark days of recognition. How did the chapel at the Evening Post get back to the stage where it was actually recognised again?
Well, as with all unions, there are certain small number of activists and a very large number of non-activists, and it was down to the activists such as myself to basically keep the union going in the dark days of derecognition, in my case 1994 to 2002. We had various dealings with the company, obviously with matters such as disciplinary matters and health and safety, but we were virtually shut out for a large part of that time. All we could do in that time was maintain our organisation, maintain our membership. And that is the thing I think that I'm most proud of as my time as FOC at the Evening Post, was not only gaining recognition again in 2002, which is obviously a great highlight, but I think the keeping the membership up in the time of derecognition, I think, was one of my sort of personal highlights, because when we got to 2002, we'd been derecognised for 8 years. I think our membership was still at 75%, and that took a lot of doing on my part to persuade people gently that the union was the right place to be. I had a fairly good record in keeping recruitment up, and involving, some people, of course, rush to join the union because there will always be people who want to be a member of the union. But, of course, there's always lots of people who are not too sure, and I think those people just need to be made aware of, what the union stands for, what its policies are, why it exists, and what we think people can get out of being in a union.
Why? This is one of the things that fascinates me, is during a period of derecognition, it must be very difficult to convince someone that it's worth paying union fees, union dues, when the company's actually negotiating with people individually.
Yeah, it's not as difficult as you might think. One good reason for that is because the management were absolutely behaving atrociously. And people could see that. It's not as if you have to win an argument to say, well, I think the management are behaving badly, and I think their philosophy are on the way of doling out whatever money is available is wrong. People could just see that people were being treated very, very badly.
Can you just give us an example of the sort of thing which would make journalists at the Post realise that it was worth being in the union just simply because they had such a draconian management? Just an example.
Well, people were given jobs to do, and there was no question of being nice about it. You did as you were told. It's difficult to sort of say it these days, but you did as you were told, because people were sort of quite cowed into... People had lots of personal problems about it because people were treated so badly. And, you know, some people were sacked, with a minute's notice. And one person I remember was sacked on a Friday evening at 5 o'clock once. And I think when managements behave as they do, people can see it. It's quite apparent which side you should be on, especially when people from the union, such as myself, are going around saying, well, this is wrong. There's got to be a better way of organising ourselves. Because the workplace, your working day is quite a large part of your waking hours. You probably spend more time at work than you might do with your family. And especially when, you know, you have to work lots of overtime for no pay whatsoever, as was the case at the Evening Post. Lots of people were putting in lots and lots of hours. We, for instance, it got so bad that we sent a petition to the editor at one point saying we were working massively over our hours, which we didn't mind doing originally, just to sort of make the paper better, obviously. But you get fed up with it once you've been doing it for a while. And they just wrote back to us telling us that we should be pleased to be working for such a good newspaper. It's absolutely atrocious. So when people behave like that, people do naturally side with a trade union. And as, of course, in the early 90s, the government itself was becoming more and more corrupt. And the whole climate at that time was that there was a lot of injustices going on here. And it was quite easy to see, really. So people did see in the union something that could possibly defend them in the worst case scenario if they were disciplined in some way, and also a lot of people just did see that there was a history of a trade union movement that was something that they should belong to, and I hope that will continue. It has continued for in this country for 300 years now, and I'm hoping that it will continue for a much longer period as well. There are trying times just now at the Bristol Evening Post. There is a ballot for to recognise the Western Daily Press alongside the Bristol Evening Post, and management are putting on people even as we speak to turn away from the union. But
you mentioned people being basically told what to do by the editors and management, and this creating a bad atmosphere. How did that actually reflect in the newspaper, in the editorial policy of the newspaper? Because obviously, you know, journalists are coming to news meetings in the morning with their own ideas, their own angles on stories. Did you find that there was quite a heavy-handed editorial approach?
No, I don't think that, I wouldn't call it heavy-handed, because I think editors don't need to be heavy-handed. What generally happens, and certainly what happened at the Evening Post, I think what happens generally in newspapers, is that new editors come in with a philosophy, a way of that they think the paper should be run, and a way that stories should be written and found. And they generally surround themselves with deputy editors, news editors, who have the same idea. And if they don't have the same idea, they soon get the same idea, because their livelihoods depend on it. And so you find that quite surreptitiously and subconsciously, people start writing stories and seeking out stories and deciding what stories are news quite quickly to coincide with the editor's wishes, really. And I think that happens in every newspaper. And I think to some extent it's that's fair enough. Just because you might disagree with an editor who has a right wing agenda, as I do, doesn't mean that
we'll have a right wing agenda.
as I do disagree with those editors, but you know, they got every perfect right. I was happy to say that when Mike Lowe took over from Adrian Faber at the Evening Post, the pendulum swung the other way. I was quite pleased to see that Mike Lowe got the editorship of the paper, basically on a philosophy of taking the paper back up market slightly, a more liberal agenda, you know, lots to do with more sort of middle class origins, you might say, things like culture, arts, restaurants. Became more of a feature, and also a more even-handed look at the news as well. And people also got to know the way that Mike wanted stories in the paper as well. So I don't think generally editors have to be too heavy-handed. They soon get their way.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about this struggle for recognition, which happened in. Successfully, finally, in 2002. For those who are looking for recognition now, have you got any tips for people as to how to build up the support for the union and then finally to actually get recognition?
Well, I think that there's no getting around it. What you've got to do is get the membership up, and that's a quite difficult process. There's no easy way of doing that. Except to continually keep asking people, will they join? Keep telling people what you think the benefits of membership are. And you will get people not joining, you will get some people joining, but it is a long process and you have to work at it. And if you're not up for that, then it suddenly becomes a very difficult job. I was up for it because I could see I was spurred on by the injustices that I saw around me, and I just thought, I've got to do something about this. So that's what spurred me on to it. Because when you're working hard as a journalist, you know, you're overworked already. To actually find time to do union work is very difficult because you don't get a lot of spare time, and. So that's the difficult part of it, and that's what has got the groundwork for getting recognition is all about getting the membership really up to a good level, and I think from those roots the rest of it naturally follows. You've got to then once you've got the membership to a certain level, you know, preferably about 2/3 would be good if possible. You've then got to up the ante. Then you've got to start having campaigns and the public campaigns and getting people on your side, having meetings, obviously. But generally, the main thing, I think, is keeping an eye on the membership. You know, people leave all the time. People join all the time. The staffing at the paper is always in flux. And you've just got to keep on top of it. And that is the basic of number of getting recognition, I think, getting the membership up and then having a publicity campaign, getting the help of the union nationally with the national offices on your side. And that's the way we did it at the Evening Post. And I'm really pleased to say that we had a resounding success when the Bristol Evening Post went for recognition in 2002. We got everything we asked for, in fact, we were given, despite the best efforts of the management to derail us. They had so many different tactics to try and derail us. It was unbelievable. We were obviously not allowed to meet on the premises, but who cares? You know, we had been an underground organisation for years, and a few more months wouldn't do us any harm. So we had to meet off the premises. Originally, I couldn't use you know, phones, emails, faxes, for fear of being sacked. And so a lot of my work had to be done off the premises. When it came to the recognition process itself, course, it was in management's interest to try and get people to disassociate themselves from the union. What did they do? They said that they told all the senior staff that their senior roles were not compatible with union membership, thereby putting the frighteners not only on the senior people, but the people who were below the senior people who wanted the seniors' jobs. But I'm pleased to say that the vast majority of journalists at the Evening Post stood up to that naked threat and supported the union. Of course, when it came to the actual process of going through to the CAC, the Central Arbitration Committee, which is the government body that oversees the recognition in trade unions, the company tried to fill the numbers on their side, incredibly, to the extent that they decided that secretaries, copy takers, messengers were all now one big part of the editorial family who should be represented by the NUJ. Of course, the NUJ didn't particularly want to represent people who were not journalists, unbelievably. And but not only that, but there were also quite a few kids who used to get the results on Saturday afternoon for the sports paper, the Green, and these kids were only about 15, 16. They used to ring round the various football clubs on local league level to get the results for the paper, and the company even involved them in the, said that they should be involved in the balloting process. It was amazing. These kids were still eating sweets at the time, and to be asking them about trade union issues was slightly, I think, a bit silly. But needless to say, the CAC said this is absolutely pathetic, that the company should be doing this. The company lost a lot of face with the CAC. The CAC eventually gave us a so-called bargaining unit, who are the people that the union represents, that is the bargaining unit. And the CAC granted the union, after a hearing down in London, the exact bargaining unit that we asked for as a union. We won 100% hands down. And it was another great moment in trade union history, volume 10. Of course, all these moments are just like very small moments in what is usually in the life of a trade unionist. Lots and lots of misery, and every now and again a fantastic victory which keeps you going.
What was the actual result on the ground, though, day to day after recognition? Was there a palpable change in the building?
Yeah, well, there was. Yeah, we had an immediate sort of presence in the building, which was legitimate, which was recognised, and the company couldn't go back on it. Regardless of the fact that the company had previously said that they would fight the trade unions on the beaches. It was Northcliffe's quote. And, well, we did meet them on the beach and we did beat them. And in our day-to-day life, it was much better. We had an immediate legitimacy, I think, was the main thing that we... It was seen as a natural occurrence that the union should be involved in the way the workplace was organised and the way that things got done. It seems incredible, doesn't it, to say that, you know, in the workplace, the views of the workforce should be taken into account. It's not asking for the world, but this is what we were struggling to get through for many years. With recognition, that is exactly what we got. We got the views of the workforce were now being taken into consideration with varying degrees of success. It also meant that we had wage negotiations were formalised, and we had a claim in every year. Previously, if many people did not get pay rises, I suppose some people will be surprised to hear that. But when we were de-recognised and people had to negotiate their own wage rise, many people, most of the people being people who were not complete yes men and women, some of these people did not get wage rises from one year to another. And it was mainly because their face didn't fit, and that was the only reason. And well, that all stopped once the union was organised and got negotiating rights. Everybody got a pay rise. And in our first year, we weighted it in favour of the low paid, so that the low paid people got a much higher percentage rise than the higher paid people did. So to the effect that some of the really low paid people got a 20% wage rise in the first year. And we having an organised trade union meant that we could keep an eye on various other things to do with wages and conditions, like you know, the various allowances that people got for working Saturdays on the sports paper, working Sundays, working night shifts. All these were kept tabs on, and we managed to raise these allowances for people year on year, having had not risen for many years before that. So on the monetary side, I think things were progressing. Of course, it wasn't easy because Northcliffe were avowedly anti-union, and we were the only union, the only NUJ chapel to get recognition in the entire country, in the Northcliffe Empire. And Northcliffe really wanted to defeat us, basically. So they didn't make things easy. I'm not saying that everything became a utopian society. You know, we found it difficult on wage negotiations to get anything above a certain inflation-type level. But at least we were getting more and more organised. But I do know that Northcliffe saw it as the be-all and end-all to get rid of the union in Bristol, because we were an example to other Northcliffe chapels who were lining up now to in the early part of the 2000s to get recognition after us. And I think if what happened was that the company were trying their level best to make things difficult for the union in Bristol, in order that we couldn't be a shining example to other chapels in the Northcliffe Empire throughout the region, because they desperately wanted to get rid of the union.
Now, you were, I think, a sub on the paper, weren't you?
The great time for me on the Evening Post, on the Substack particularly, stemmed from the great camaraderie of the subs desk. There was a team of about 15 to 20 of us, depending on the number of editions that we're at one point making. And the camaraderie and the banter between everyone was in between the very, very hard work, was fantastic. And the amount of laughs we had, mainly because of the fantastic characters that we had, was superb, really. I mean, we had a lot of the banter would roll off the news, obviously, we were putting in the paper, and off the headlines that we were writing. And we just you know, you develop a little language of your own over the years as to what makes you laugh. And we I'm pleased to say that amidst some of the grimness of the way the company did treat us, that we did have some fantastic laughs. All journalists work towards deadlines. But I think especially on an evening paper, when you're working in the morning to have the paper out in the evening, there is a great sense of excitement at meeting the deadlines. We generally had five deadlines in the morning, starting around first one at 9 o'clock, and then the last one around 2 o'clock. And it's, if we'd say I had five deadlines, it's five different races to win. And of course, that is adds a lot of excitement to the actual goings on in the morning. Of course, things go wrong and things get panicky. And it's trying to make things happen when things are going wrong, that you rely on your fellow workers to get you out of holes sometimes. And that's when that's when the camaraderie helps. I'm pleased to say that in my time at the Evening Post, I couldn't have wished to work with so hard-working, diligent bunch of people. Everybody worked hard for each other. There was no one who took a back seat. And I think that was one of the great things about working in our team, was that everyone had great respect for each other, because everyone knew everyone was doing their best to try in difficult circumstances. And so it was quite exciting when the deadlines would come up every sort of hour, and to get one edition of the paper finished and get a new edition up and going within the hour was a tall order, and it meant working really, really quickly. But that was part of the attraction of it, really, for many of us. It was the excitement of it, and the sense of achievement at the end of it that kept a lot of us going.
What tips would you have for anyone starting in journalism now to sort of shortcut some of the rough experience that journalists have in their career?
Yeah, I don't think, sadly, this isn't a very optimistic viewpoint, I'm saying. So I think most trade unions are optimists because they do believe that you can change the world for the better. But with regard to the provincial press, I'm afraid I'm not an optimist. I see the exploitation of workers in the national provincial press particularly growing. Of course, the only way to stop that is to have a strong trade union, the National Union of Journalists, to try and bring some sense of justice to the whole situation. So the first thing I would tell people who are starting out on journalism, especially in print journalism, is to join the union, because it's the only people that will protect you if things start to go wrong, if employers want to start exploiting people more and more. The union will be the only people that will help you to actually get into journalism in the first place. Yeah, I think you must have to try and do some voluntary work in some outlet or other before you even try to get into it. But having got a job in provincial press, I think the only way you can make it better is to join a trade union. Try and stick with that union, and hopefully the management that you're up against will try to see that it's not just exploiting its workforce that it is going to be the future of continued profitability of papers. It's actually having a well-trained, well-paid workforce that delivers a quality product. I think that's the only way forward for the provincial press. Sadly, as I said, I'm not a great optimist that the owners of the national press actually think in those terms. I think they still, as we speak, they're still looking at the bottom line. Northcliffe itself actually wanted to get out of newspapers only 2 years ago, and it was only because they couldn't find anyone to buy it off them that they're still there. But hopefully that everyone can change, and I hope Northcliffe do. I hope that they'll turn around and see that the workforce, their workforce, should be involved in their industry to a much larger extent for the benefit of all concerned.